1059 The Region, in partnership with RE/MAX Prime Properties, present On the Market, real estate advice that works for you. Have a real estate question? Call us at 416-335-1059. Tweet us at 1059 The Region or email us at info@1059theregion.com.
This is 105.9 The Region. I'm Tina Cortez with On the Market, York Region's exclusive radio real estate show. Our expert from RE/MAX Prime Properties is Asif Khan. Good morning, Asif.
Good morning, Tina.
Now, according to the Canadian Real Estate Association, February home sales jumped 19.7% from a year ago. That story from the Canadian Press.
CREA says the increase partly reflects weakness last year and that February sales were one of the lowest for the month in the past two decades. But senior economist Sean Cathcart believes February could end up being the last relatively uneventful month for the year for home sales due to pent-up demand that's been put on hold as interest rates remain high. The actual national average home price was $685,809 last month, up 3.5% from February of last year. Don Kelly, The Canadian Press.
Home sales certainly are up, Tina, and joining us is Benji Katchen from Wahi. Benji, welcome back to On the Market.
Thank you. Nice to be here.
Benji, sure feels like a spring market, even though the weather earlier this week didn't reflect it, but it's been hot out there, and you have a report about bidding wars and multiple offers. Tell us a little bit more about that.
Sure. We track market pulse of 400 neighborhoods across the GTA, and it's been a very cold winter in terms of bidding and overbidding. In fact, through December and January, we haven't seen a single neighborhood in the 400 that we track in the GTA being overbid. And suddenly, February has sprung to life again, and 25% of the neighborhoods across the GTA are now in overbidding territory.
Okay, so tell us about the top five GTA overbidding neighborhoods.
Sure. There's five neighborhoods at the top. Victoria Square in Markham was a median sold price of $1.5 million. The average overbidding in February was $255,000 over asking price. We also had Salem Heights in Ajax, Lytton Park in Toronto, Northwood Park in Brampton, and Amberlea in Pickering. And those are just the top five. But in addition to those, there's another 100 or so that are now in overbidding territory, and are certainly all the realtors I talk to out there are starting to be, not always, but many times in bidding wars once again.
Hmm. And Benji, when we're talking about bidding wars and overbidding, what would be some areas where buyers can still get a deal? So maybe some underbidding areas.
Sure. I think The inverse of the 25% that are overbid, there's still 75% of the neighborhoods throughout the GTA that are in underbidding territory, and they're not just in one area. They're all over the city. We have a map on our site that tracks real-time where it's overbid and underbid, and it's throughout the GTA from west to east, north to south. There's still underbidding territories. What we're seeing, however, is there seems to be this sweet spot in around between 800,000 and 1.2 million for detached or semi-detached homes, where we're seeing bidding wars go on right now. It's a little less hot on the bidding war front, at least for condos, for sure.
And what can you tell us about the condo market? I guess it's not seeing as much, you know, bidding competition.
So we actually only saw, of the 400 neighborhoods we tracked, we only saw 10 of them that were in overbidding territory in February. That's up from zero in January. There's another six neighborhoods that we're selling at asking, but the vast majority, 88% of the neighborhoods, are in underbidding territory for condos. So there's still a robust condo market, but it's certainly less hot from bidders getting out there and participating in bidding wars. And the inverse of the bidders getting in bidding wars is listing sellers or listing agents representing sellers trying to actually probably get a little bit more realistic on prices over the last month or so, and in some cases actually lowering it below the true value of what the house is actually worth to try to spark those bidding wars and to try to actually determine what is the market price that somebody's willing to pay for that house. And often when it's quite a bit below what the true value is, many bidders come out and bid to see if they can maybe get a bit of a deal.
And I was going to add exactly that, Benji, is that even though we're starting to see multiple offers in bidding where some of these prices are so low that they're not realistic, and the prices that people are selling at is still about market value. Is that what you found as well?
We found the exact same thing, Asif, is that we have an online instant estimator of house prices, and often we like to predict what's the house really going to sell for. And oftentimes we see that house where our tool says, well, it's probably worth between $1 million and $1.2 million, and somebody goes and lists it for $799. We say, okay, we know that one's going to be a bidding war. And then what happens is it sells for between $1 and $1.2 million, just like true value is, or other comparables on the street or in the neighborhood actually sell for.
So what's your advice then to our listeners, to anyone reading this report? How should they interpret these statistics?
So I think that the statistics are great at a high level, but really what I always say when I'm asked this question is buyers or sellers have to do their due diligence. They have to really get in the know. They have to look at lots of listings, look at lots of listings that have sold, understand a property they're bidding on, what do they think it's actually really worth. There's tools online to help with that. I also think that there's many realtors that are professionals that have a lot of experience in local neighborhoods that can also help and really know what the price and value is so that you don't get carried away in a bidding war and you don't pay more than true value. There's nothing worse than having buyers regret by paying $50,000 or $100,000 above what something is actually worth. So you want to win it if you really want it, but not by paying too much.
And with that said, there's also the appraisal aspect as well. Benji, as the market starts to heat up and we get a little bit more inventory and maybe more buyers off the fence with the promise of rates cuts to come, how do you see bidding wars moving forward? Do you think we're going to see a lot more in those overbid territories? And will everyone else catch up and will we be in multiple offers everywhere?
Last April, May, and June, we saw between 57 and 68% of all neighborhoods in the GTA in overbidding territory. And that's sort of a very, what I would consider to be a very robust spring market where houses get listed. If they get priced right, they move very, very quickly. And with that tight pricing, multiple bidders show up for bidding wars. I think that if interest rates fall a little bit, we're seeing that there's quite a bit of pent-up demand in the market. Housing construction isn't keeping pace with the growth of the population in the GTA, and 100%, there will be bidding wars through the spring, and they might even be quite robust if there's at least interest rates hold flat or potentially a little bit of a drop in rates.
And do you think, Benji, that it is the first-time home buyer that is causing these bidding wars and these multiple offers, or is it every buyer out there?
I think it's a bit of a mix. Tina, 50% of all homes purchased are by first-time homebuyers in the GTA. So by definition, those are people trying to get into the market, and certainly the houses in the neighborhoods that we're seeing overbid are at or near price points around $1 million, $1.1 million, $1.2 million, where it's a lot of first-time homebuyers buying. So for sure we're seeing that effect, but I think it's also across different house prices. Like one of the neighborhoods is Litton Park. That's a $2.1 million neighborhood. That's not a typical first-time homebuyer neighborhood. So it's also potentially move-up buyers as well.
And with the buyers that are on your app searching for a home, what would be the magic price point? What's the most popular price point that they're looking in? And does that coincide with the areas that are overbid areas?
I'd say the median price of homes that Wahi buyers are buying right now are right around the $1 million mark, and our primary consumer are couples buying their first home, and that's exactly what they're doing, and they're buying in those neighborhoods where they're in multiple bidding wars. We've had at least a dozen offers over the last week or two that were in multiple bidding situations with our clients. Sometimes it takes those clients, if they're determined, to get to the second or third shot actually bidding before they actually find the house and they're able to land an offer that's accepted by a seller. And definitely, Asif, it's in that $1 million range. You know, the inverse of this are the neighborhoods that are underbid. We also have the top underbid neighborhoods. all of those neighborhoods are between 1.7 million and 3.7 million in price. So there's also a theme there that not exclusively, because I mentioned Lytton Park is overbid right now, but many of like York Mills, North York, or Eastlake, Oakville, Kingsway, South Etobicoke, King City, Esquissing, and Milton, those are all more expensive neighborhoods, and they're just a little bit underbid. For the most part, the underbid amount is like 4 or 5% below asking, so it's not a huge underbid. Like, we're getting close to equilibrium in pricing in the GTA, where there's a price where sellers are willing to accept and buyers can afford it in the market right now. So things are starting to move again.
Benji, if our listeners want to read the report, where can they find it?
So they can go to www.wahi.com, W-A-H-I.com, or to the Android or iOS App Store to download the WAHI app.
Benji, thanks so much for joining us again. We look forward to speaking with you soon.
Okay, my pleasure. Thank you, Tina. Thank you, Asif.
After the break, landlords and tenants. This is On the Market on 105.9 The Region. Stay with us.
Need to connect with Asif Khan from RE/MAX Prime Properties? Call him, 416-985-KHAN. That's 416-985-5426. Or email asif@thehomeshop.ca. Now, back to On the Market on 105.9 The Region.
Welcome back to On the Market, York Region's radio real estate show. Over to my co-host and our real estate expert, Asif Khan, from RE/MAX Prime Properties, as we shift our focus to the Landlord-Tenant Board. Asif?
Thank you, Tina. Joining us again is Simona Zaslavsky from Mayfair Law. Simona, welcome back to On the Market.
Thank you so much for having me back, guys.
Simona, I know some landlords are not going to be happy with this, but you have some information about certain municipalities passing bylaws that may actually protect the tenants more. Tell us a little bit about that.
Yeah, landlords have not been happy with me or in general these days with recent changes in the last few months, but unfortunately that's the tone that's been happening. I think it started off this year in January where they had a bylaw passed in Hamilton. Hamilton was the first Ontario municipality that required a license, required Hamilton landlords to have a license for any renovictions. So what's a renoviction? A renoviction is an eviction because the landlord needs to renovate. Because Hamilton has had a huge increase, probably, I think I read it was like a 900% increase from 2017 in the need to renovate and the need to evict the tenants as a result, that the bylaw was apparently needed. So now what happens is a landlord needs to go and get a license before they even send the form to the tenant.
Simona, you said this is a 900% increase in Hamilton alone. Why is the municipality then intervening and getting involved in this landlord-tenant transaction?
I think there is a big disparity between the landlords and the tenants in Hamilton specifically. I think there's a very large amount of tenants that are on subsidized housing, that they may be, you know, a specific class that they need more protection. So the municipality sees them as needing more protection than the landlords in this case specifically.
And then we move into who's going to protect a landlord? Because on the flip side, we're hearing of tenants that are racking up their arrears and they may not pay up in time when it's time for them to leave. What are you hearing about that?
There is no protection for landlords. I'm not even going to sugarcoat it. There's no protection when it comes to landlords. If the tenant doesn't pay, racks up, you know, tons of money in arrears. There was an article. It wasn't an article. There was a post in Guelph that I had seen. A tenant racked up over $40,000 in arrears, filed for bankruptcy, sought protection from the creditors. You know, so let's say now they have protection from the creditors. So they don't have that money to give back. They don't have that $40,000. Now the landlord has no money. The landlord's out a lot of money in, you know, what they're supposed to pay for their mortgage. the bank comes and says, hey, where's my money? So now the landlord's going to lose the house. Who helps the landlord? Absolutely nobody. These landlords that have to get these licenses, that are expected to get these licenses in Hamilton, they have to pay, I think it's $800 to apply for this license. And they have to already have all the permits. So that's more money to even get that approval. And if they do it in bad faith, they get fined $500 a day. So it's just constant banging into the landlord's pocket. And Hamilton's first. London's coming up next. Brampton has their own licenses that they require landlords to have in order to be a landlord.
So this seems to be a move then to protect tenants, because there are those landlords who are creating these scenarios where they want to renovate, you know, their spaces and evict tenants so they can basically, you know, increase the rent. Is that not what's happening?
It is what's happening, but it's also not what's happening because some of these renovations are required. Some of them are immediate. Some of them are urgent. Some of them are, you know, for the safety of the tenants themselves. It can go both ways, but the problem is that it seems that in every scenario, it's only to protect the tenants, to make sure that when they leave, when they're asked to leave and come back, they come back at the same price of what they were paying for before. But if it's a year later, things change. We don't know what's going to happen in a year. Nobody has that crystal ball, unfortunately, but the tenants still have to be in the same place they were when they left.
And a lot of investors are now turning to Alberta and beyond, where they're not stuck with the same landlord-tenant acts that we have in Ontario. And that's going to be a relatively big blow for Ontario in terms of keeping that investment money within the province. Do you think there's any reform in sight or anything that could come about to help make it a level playing field?
I don't think anything is going to change. It only seems to be getting tighter and tighter for the landlords. I don't know what the end game is for the province, to be honest with you. People are turning to me every time I talk about it, every time I have, you know, an information session about it. Everyone turns to me and says, why be a landlord? I don't want to be a landlord. I'm scared to be a landlord. And when landlords are calling me, they're calling me scared, because they're afraid that they're going to lose their house, a property that they invested in a long time ago, a property that they want to pass down to their children, a property that they need for their elderly parents. I don't see this getting better. Not today, I don't.
Gosh, it doesn't sound encouraging at all out there. So, Simone, you've joined us numerous times with updates from the Landlord-Tenant Board. What is the current state of affairs there? Is there still a backlog?
Nothing has changed. The backlog is still 6 to 8 months when it comes to being heard. There's still the same 6 to 8 weeks waiting for an order or a decision from the adjudicator. And there's still the same backlog in getting the sheriff to come to the home to actually do the eviction. So we're still looking at, you know, 12 months. We're still looking at up to a year.
And some landlords may be listening and thinking, you know what, I'm just going to end this nightmare. I'm going to sell the property and be done with being a landlord. But then we're hearing that tenants aren't leaving. Is that still an issue at the LTB, where, you know, the cash for keys and tenants refusing to leave, or even when the place is sold and the tenant has said, I will leave on this day, they're staying? How do we get them out?
So N12s, which are the forms that are required to either get the tenant out because you've sold the property or you want to use it for your own personal use or an immediate family member, those applications, those forms are up actually 77% since October. So since October, 6 months ago. Those are just getting a lot harder. Cash for keys is becoming the unlawful norm of getting somebody out as fast as possible. And the tenants know this. They know that there's a backlog. They know that they have this option. They know that they don't have to go anywhere. Everyone says the same thing to tenants. The only way a tenancy can end is either by you leaving or the board making you leave. No other way can force, nobody else can force you out. So they have this this protection, and it just makes it a lot harder for the landlord. How can the landlord avoid? Make sure you constantly educate yourself. Make sure you put in the right applications. Make sure you speak to a professional. Every single time, make sure you're doing the right thing. Understand what the end game is and know how you're going to get there.
Almost like legal extortion.
And even if they know,
it's not legal.
Well, and even if they know the rules of the game, though, as landlords, it still sounds like their hands are tied.
As a landlord, yeah. There's only so much that you can do as a landlord, unfortunately. There's only so much that you can do.
So, Samora, what's the next step with the LTB? Not only to shorten the delays, but maybe have something in place where landlords have some fear put back into place where, you know, it used to be before that, hey, you don't pay your rent, you get kicked out. Right now, that fear doesn't exist. So where do we go from here?
I think a good thing for the Landlord and Tenant Board to do is to start shortening these wait times. I understand that there's a backlog, but if they made it quicker, if people knew that it wouldn't last a year, if people knew that they had only 3-4 months, they wouldn't be acting this way. They wouldn't have this comfortable bed to lay on and say, okay, well, I'm good for a year. I'm good here for a year. I'm just going to, you know, kick back and relax. No, if you have that pressure of 2, 3, 4 months, you're not going to act this way. You're going to have no choice. We have to start giving both sides no choice. You have to come to an agreement.
Always great information, Samora. Thanks for joining us once again, and we look forward to getting you back on for another update in a few months.
Thanks, guys. Always great to be here.
When we come back, your real estate questions. This is On the Market on 105.9 The Region. Stay with us.
Need to connect with Asif Khan from RE/MAX Prime Properties? Call him, 416-985-KHAN. That's 416-985-5426. Or email asif@thehomeshop.ca. Now, back to On the Market on 105.9 The Region.
Welcome back to On the Market. Your questions for Asif Khan are next, and we begin with Wanda from Unionville. She wants to know, when is the ideal time to start the search to purchase a cottage property? Should she work with an agent familiar with the area, or is it okay to work with the agent who sold her York Region home? Asif, what do you think?
Great question. And the ideal time to start looking for cottage properties is probably right around now. The snow is melting. You get boats out on the water. A lot of these properties are only accessible by boat. So again, it depends on, do you want something that's accessible 12 months a year, or are you okay with a summer type of cottage property where you can access it by water? I would say if you're looking to purchase something anywhere around waterfront, you need an expert from that area to help you out. There's so many different things that they need to be well-versed on, and that could be the waterways, the zoning, anything that is going to affect future value for you. What developments are coming up in that area? Do they have municipal water, or is it going to be coming in soon? Is it a well, and then what is the well like, the septic? There's so much that goes into these cottage properties that not just any agent would be able to assist you. So I would recommend an area expert, and especially a cottage property expert.
And what about a cottage that may be a bit of a fixer-upper? What should she be prepared for?
Again, when you have an expert from that area guiding you, they'll be able to tell you what you can and can't do with these fixer-uppers, because some of them, they may already have setbacks you may need to apply for to the city to try and get those changed or anything like that. So with the fixer-uppers, there are some available that it may only be cosmetic interior work, but if some things are falling apart or they're too close to the water or anything like that and they have to be moved, these are big decisions that need to go into that purchasing decision because it could cost you a lot of money after.
And when you're purchasing a home in the city, you often go through a home inspection, et cetera. Those same things apply when you're talking about a cottage property, right?
They really do, and they're more intense because there's a lot more to look at. Mm. There's not only the septic system, you also have to look at the wells, what type of What type of well is it? Is it a drilled well? Is it, you do water testing? There's so much that goes into the inspections when you're looking at cottage properties or waterfront properties that I can't, I can't tell you how important it is to choose an area expert.
All right. Next question. John from Newmarket will be looking for a rental property for his university student daughter in Hamilton. What does he need to know to start the search from residence to living off campus? When is a property purchase a better idea than a rental?
Well, having three kids that had to go through that same thing, it is tough. It's way tougher to find a rental for a student than it is just for a young couple or even just a single person. A lot of people don't want to rent to students, or student rentals are very expensive and they're very competitive. It may already be too late for September, as a lot of the students started looking early in March or late in February for these properties. A lot of the leases start in April as soon as the school year ends, and they're 12-month leases. So you would have to lease something from April now until next March or next April. And so that, for that reason, it could be too late. You may have slim pickings right now. You could be looking at, if you're looking to purchase a property, I would say if you have 3 or 4 years left for your child to be going there, then it may be worth it. But again, it depends on what the property is. If it's a property where you can house multiple students, it might be a better option. Your son or daughter would be able to choose who they're living with, just so that, student rentals are pretty tough because the students don't take care of it as a normal renter would. So you want to make sure that you have the right renters in there and that they're going to be taking care of the property. You might have to do some more visits as compared to just an investment property where you might visit once a year or once every 2 years. Your visits might be every month to make sure that everything is okay and everything's being taken care of.
John is talking about a rental property for his daughter, a student in Hamilton. How do those prices compare to Toronto, the GTA, York region?
So the prices are still pretty steep in Hamilton, Waterloo, around Brock University. They all seem to up the prices a little bit because they know that they're going to have a good audience from student renters. So the demand is there. The demand is high. There's not a lot of residence allocations available. So even first-year students are now looking at student rentals outside or off campus. I would even have your daughter look at some of the internal groups that are out there for student rentals, because a lot of those are, certified off-campus student rentals. There's a lot of companies that deal with that as well. So that may be an option. And it depends on if your daughter wants to live with another three people or two people or one person, because the prices are all different. Sometimes the quads are a little bit cheaper than just having a single room or a double room. So it depends on the occupancy. It depends on if you're going to be taking it from September to April. You're still going to pay the same amount, but you'll pay a lot higher monthly. It's sometimes better just to take it from April to April.
Much to consider. As a reminder, if you have questions for On the Market, send your email anytime to info@1059theregion.com. But Asif, if our listeners prefer to contact you directly, how can they connect?
They can reach me at 416-985-5426.
If you missed any part of our show, go to 1059theregion.com or wherever you get your favorite podcasts, including Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Google Podcasts, Amazon Music, and Audible. I'm Tina Cortez. For Asif Khan, thank you for listening.
Need to connect with Asif Khan from RE/MAX Prime Properties? Call him, 416-985-KHAN. That's 416-985-5426. Or email asif@thehomeshop.ca.